We are going to deal with a topic that has been referred to innumerable times already in the course of our prior discussions. It is not a new topic. It is not a topic that we have solved here in the United States. It is not a topic, therefore, that we can say that we have any solutions to countries that are engaged in changing their form of government. In some sense, the problem reminds me of the anecdote about the lady who wanted a parrot all of her life, and she went into the gift store, the pet shop, and she found that parrots who talk are quite expensive, $2,500, $5,000. And she finally saw a miserable looking bird in the corner, and she asked the pet shop owner what he would charge for that one. He said, "Madam, you don't want that one. That one was raised in a brothel, and he speaks vile language." And she said, "Well, I think I can cope with that. What's the price?" He said, $250, but no warranty. So she took him out, carrying him in the bird cage. And the first thing he did was take a look at her, and he said, "Well, new madam." She said, "You better shut up." She takes him into her home. He says, "New madam, new house." And then her daughters, who were college age, came home from school, and he said, "New madam, new house, new girls." And she said, "You'd better learn to behave yourself." And about that time, her husband came home from work, and he said, "New madam, new house, new girls, same old George." The problem with the judiciary and the rule of law is the same old George. Now, we do have an assumption that all of us are making that does not go without challenge, particularly in American academic circles, the critical legal studies movement, and in certain linguistic and semantic studies, the deconstructionist movement, and that is the basic notion that you can, in words, promulgate a rule that can be successfully applied according to the words of the rule to resolve a dispute by the judiciary. We assume that those criticisms are wrong, and that at least in some cases, most cases, there is such a thing as a rule of law, that some governmental agency, be it in a constitutional form, a legislative form, or in some other form, promulgates the rule. And we turn to the question of, given such a rule, or given the absence of such a rule, the role of the judiciary. We know very well that putting the rules on a piece of paper is, as has been explained to us earlier today, like writing the score of Chopin. It will give you some notes to play if only you can play them, but who has the instruments and how will they play them? And we will present varying views on that. One is, what is the role of the judiciary in the interpretation and enforcement of the rule of law, and what must the judiciary depend upon? Because in no country, so far as I know, has the judiciary ever had the power of self-execution of its decrees. So what other instruments of government must, and of society, must the judiciary rely upon if there is a rule of law and the judiciary applies that rule? Now, there is never a problem when the application of the rule meets with universal favor. The executive likes it, the legislature likes it, the people like it. The problem arises when, of course, the judiciary says the rule of law is this, the executive has a different view, and the people, the democracy, has a quite different view. So we consider both the political as well as the jurisprudential and social aspects of the problem. Indeed, I ask you to consider, as you hear our various discussions, the question of whether the notion of a government of laws, not of men, as we are fond of putting it in that aphorism, is not so much a legal or a legislative or a political matter as a cultural matter, dependent upon the mental habits and the institutions of society rather than purely upon its institutions of government. Does the willingness of a losing party to accept an adverse ruling itself constitute a social habit that must be inculcated in some other way than by a jurisprudential decision and some dependence on the willingness of an executive to enforce them? I will not spend our time on introducing in detail each of our speakers, their biographies, in detail or in the little pamphlet that I think all of you are familiar with and has been distributed with you. We are going to start with Professor DeMosca of Yale, who's had considerable experience teaching comparative law, a native of Yugoslavia, who came to the United States in 1972 and is taught at both the University of Pennsylvania and Yale Law School. Professor DeMosca.
What I think is fitting when we... Is it working?
No.
I have to hold. Is it okay now? If you're pushing, this is also not going to work. What I think is fitting as a point of entry into the problems this panel will briefly consider is something that is not terribly romantic or exciting, and I'll leave it to people who follow me to deal with them. But what I would like to briefly suggest is that the rule of law is a immensely vague concept, and what is interesting, I think, for this group is to realize that there are differences in the conception of the rule of law in the Anglo-American, particularly the American world, in continental Europe, and these differences are reflected to a certain extent in what went on in Eastern European countries during the reign of communism, and may give you some inkling into the emerging conception of a rule of law in Eastern Europe. Now, all that I can suggest in these brief few minutes at my disposal is to suggest, or like pointers, in the direction of these different conceptions. And the best thing is to ask ourselves, what is it that we really mean by rule of law in this country? I have conducted, before coming to New Orleans, a little poll of the faculty I come from on this issue, and I will, for reasons of loyalty to the institution that pays me, not reveal what the outcome of that polling was, except to say that there was a tremendous variety of view, astonishing to me, although I suspected that there was going to be a variety of views. Now, leaving to one side the very important internal differences between people who believe in judicial activism, even of some kind of uninhibited sort, on the one hand, and people who believe in strict constructionism or what have you, I think that from a broad comparative point of view, the essence of the rule of law, at least as compared to the Europeans, in this country is not so much on the fact that the substantive decision maker, the judge, is narrowly constrained by an enactment, some kind of a written rule of law, even on the part of those who do not believe in the activist judiciary. comparatively speaking. Decision, substantive decision, to a great extent, in our legal culture, American legal culture, is more flexible. Just notice the fact, which is so striking comparatively, that any judge can enter into the constitutionality of the statute. At least in theory, any judge, even the lowest judge, can declare a statute unconstitutional, which is almost hard to comprehend to other culture. And what does it really mean? It means that there's a certain amount of flexibility because you are confronted, at least in theory, and there's a tremendous amount of flexibility because you are confronted with a statute, and you may say it does not accord with the Constitution. And constitutional concepts, of course, particularly with relatively vague stare decisis in the area, are somewhat flexible. So you introduce a certain element of flexibility. And for these and other reasons that we have no time to enter into here, probably what is significant about our conception of the rule of law is the procedural more than the substantive side. Because what is so striking, I think, for our conception is the fact that we believe that rule of law is to a great extent linked to the idea that you can have a recourse to the judge at one point, to the judiciary, and also with the procedural conceptions like the habeas corpus, right to hearing, right to present your case in court. Now notice the assumptions behind this somewhat proceduralist, although that could be caricatured. I'm not saying there's nothing substantive. What lies behind this conception of the rule of law? Surely also a certain notion or tradition of the judiciary, which is not a civil service, bureaucratic, technocratic judiciary, but is a judiciary with people who are independent in their own right. Let's say people in the second career, people who have left their mark on society, who are important actors in their own right. And judges, to a certain extent, who are above the fray, because we should not forget that the jury has enabled our judiciary a certain luxury of standing above the fray, so that the judge may appear as a kind of neutral position. If you look at the continental side, and I will just glimpse at it briefly, you will see that the judges, as a result of a different tradition, did not have that luxury of appearing as being above the fray, whereas the parties, as in an adversary system, fight it out in court. Now, what do continentals mean by the rule of law? You see, it is true that they also believe, and that will be obvious in the Eastern European movement at this moment, they believe that there should be an access to court. Forget about the procuracy, Russian style, and complaints. We have to have an access to courts, let's say with administrative decisions and that sort of thing. However, the central idea of the continental rule of law is not so much access to courts, because in Europe they insist, the Germans have a great phrase, gesetzlicher Richter, that is to say, a judge which is put into notion acts according to an enactment or written law. There's the conception that if a judge has discretion, or if the judge is not narrowly circumscribed by a legislative enactment, by statute, he is no longer a proper judge. Until recently, this notion went so far that it was viewed as totally inappropriate for the judge to enter into the question of constitutionality of statutes. The notion was, this is a political decision. And the judge is not a politician. There is some technique. First of all, he is bound by the language of an enacted, of a particular enactment, as a statute, legislative statute. And also there's a certain technique, autonomous technique, which pushes to results. And professionalism is the guarantee of judicial independence. After the disappointments of the Second World War, a reaction has set in, and as you now know, to a great extent under American influence, Europeans have adopted a judicial review, although this is not the American system of judicial review. It is a system where judges cannot strike any judge. Judges normally cannot strike down a statute that is unconstitutional. It is rather the business of a special court. And more or less, in all countries, people will say it is a quasi-court. It is not really a court. It is stuffed with politicians and they make political decisions. And we don't want to spread the virus of politicization throughout the judiciary. There's a sharper dichotomy between what is legal and what is not legal. With this, I quickly turn, because my time is running out, to the so-called socialist legality. In the first phase, the socialist legality meant basically the following. The idea that texts constrain, that formalism constrains, is a fetishism. It is an illusion. The separation of powers is also just a bourgeois obfuscation that does not exist. So what do we do in a socialist country? We decide according, that was the original conception, according to the interests of the toiling masses. When you reflect for a second and look at the critical legal studies and take away the hermeneutics and the post-deconstructionism and all that fashionable, presently fashionable stuff, it is almost like listening to a critical legal studies person talking about legal system. However, what happened when critical legal studies people got into power? Of course, I'm joking and I'm talking about the situation in post-Leninist Russia. Then they developed a different conception. Lenin was realizing that although texts do not bind, they do, however, bring a certain uniformity to the application of law. So he said, this is a celebrated statement of, I'm looking for Russians, of Lenin's, I don't want my laws to be differently applied in Kaluga and Kazan. So as a result of that, there was a reversion to something that looked on paper like the continental version, and I see my time is nearing to an end, although I just have the exciting things in store, but I will skip them. And so as a result of that, you see, it looked like it is a continental conception, yet it was not, because it was contrary to the planned economy, it was contrary to the totalitarian state, which had also ambitions to raise the consciousness of the masses. This is the precise expression of critical legal studies people, raising consciousness, and all kinds of things like that. Now, skipping again vast periods of time, let me just say what is happening in my view nowadays, what we can expect to happen in Eastern Europe. In the first phase, second phase I cannot talk about, in the first phase we are going to have a reaction to the pre-existing situation. That is to say, we are going to have a tremendous opposition to a judicial activity which is not going to be narrowly constrained by circumscribed by statute. There's also going to be a tremendous aversion to any kind of preaching or educational consciousness raising on the part of judges. This is just anathema in this view. What is also going true is an emphasis on judicial independence, reintroduce tenure, ask critical legal people the question whether or not text constrain them in terms of losing tenure. They will probably say that although texts are imminently flexible, you cannot fire them because there's this provision of tenure. So you're going to have a tremendous emphasis of some kind of an old-fashioned view of rule of law, but primarily along continental lines. And what you should never suggest to people from Eastern Europe is to visit leading American law school nowadays, because they will run away, will say, this is back to where we just emerged, and we don't want to.
There are no crits on the panel. Our next speaker, Dr. Gabor Palmoy, is a professor at the Budapest University of Economics and is also chief counsel to the Constitutional Court of the Republic of Hungary, which, as you would divine from its very title, is a recently created court. And he is going to speak to us in English in the question and answer session. He says he may be obliged to turn to his interpreter to be sure he is getting the nuances.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, my English is slightly better than your Hungarian, I think, but I will try, and I have an interpreter standing by for the discussion. As early as last summer, an American politologist, Francis Fukuyama, had predicted a little bitterly the end of history and the advent of centuries of boredom, saying that the triumph of Western liberal ideas was bringing to an end and viable alternatives. Well, now I have come from a part of the world where, in the opinion of many, history is just starting or restarting. In the wake of the rapid collapse of Soviet-type regimes in Central and Eastern Europe, the question is sharply raised, where and how to go on? Is there really but one way out? True, liberal democracy, which had in this century to meet the challenge of both fascism and communism, has even in this region no viable alternative in the long run. These days, however, in order to comfort Mr. Fukuyama, in Central and Eastern Europe, essentially divergent models are emerging. Even in countries accepting the basic principles of liberalism, there are several options to take, as is also exemplified by the divergent practices of Western democracies. What are the foundational principles and what are the alternatives upon to the countries of our region? Guaranteeing human rights and power sharing. They are the two fundamental pillars of re-establishment of the rule of law. These are today the central tasks of transforming the political system. But how? As regards human rights and their protection, one of the solutions is the German way, that is, regulation partly in the Constitution, partly in separate acts of Parliament. The 1949 Bonn Basic Law can serve as our model. It has already proved efficient in the democratic transformation both of Portugal and Spain. This is one of the ways of abolishing dictatorial regimes. It is important, on the other hand, for us to investigate Anglo-Saxon legal systems, since a real liberal solution is represented by the well-known saying, Congress shall make no law, meaning by this that human rights are guaranteed even without a specific guarantee in statutory law. Former socialist countries do not seem, however, to be in a position yet to choose the concept of total lack of statutory foundation as regards basic rights. Today, unfortunately, a system which only guarantees rights by listing them in a constitution without spelling out the scope of these rights in statutes would not yet offer real guarantees. The historical ballast of past decades makes it necessary for a shorter or longer period to limit state power by legal regulation in order to protect human rights. The German model can provide for us a precedent, then, not because it is perfect and offers absolute salvation, but simply because Germany had similar antecedents. Liberal constitution traditions, which can be found in the history of countries in Central and Eastern Europe, can also help to shorten this process of transition. What happened in order to re-establish of the rule of law in Hungary? Amid the stormy political events of 1988-89, Hungary took a turn to become a constitutional state in the direction of re-establishing the rule of law and having a real constitution. According to the famous Article 16 of the French Declaration of Human and Civil Rights, quote, "A society where rights are not guaranteed institutionally and in which branches of power are not separated has no constitution," unquote. In this sense, Hungary ceased to be a state possessing a constitution when the 1949 Constitution of the People's Republic, modeled on the 1936 Stalin Basic Law, was adopted. This constitution declared part of the basic citizens, not human, rights as a privilege of the party state without the legal system guaranteeing them. As regards state's organization, instead of power sharing, it interwove to unity of state and party power to a degree impossible to disentangle. In a period when the western half of Europe, the rule of law was established in the natural sense, in Hungary, even the former rule of law, guaranteeing basic legal procedures, was barely developed. This lack of constitution lasted until the comprehensive amendment to the 1949 constitution taking effect on the 33rd of October 1989, restating republic in the place of the People's Republic. According to the new preamble of the considerably amended constitution, the revision was needed, quote, "in order to promote the peaceful political transition into the rule of law, realizing the multi-party system, parliamentary democracy, and social market economy," unquote. The amended text of the Constitution says the following about the basic structural principles pervading to the new Hungarian Republic, quote, "The Hungarian Republic is an independent, democratic, constitutional state," unquote. This is the wording that replaced the regulation of the original text of the Constitution stating that Hungary was a socialist state. From the viewpoint of guaranteeing human rights and power sharing, the establishment of the constitutional court is separated from the regular courts of law of outstanding significance in Hungarian constitutional practice. The existence of a constitutional court, independent even of parliament, manifests a departure from the principle of the unity of power. The Constitutional Court, institutionalized under the amended Constitution, was granted the right to repeal unconstitutional bills. In addition, Parliament, one of its standing committees, or 50 members, can initiate an inquiry into the constitutionality of a bill not yet passed. In the event of a violent of one's rights guaranteed in the Constitution, one can directly turn to the court if one's grievance was made while an unconstitutional legal rule was being applied. It was a subject of lengthy debates in the political legitimation of the court can be secured in the Constitutional Court gets its mandate from a parliament of doubtful legitimacy. In the end, when the act came into force in November 1989, only 5 members were selected by the parliament, elected in spring 1990, whereas appointing the remaining 5 will be the duty of the parliament functioning in the 5th year following the establishment of the court. With the constitutional making of 1989-1990, outlined above the codifying activity aimed at restoring the rule of law cannot, of course, be regarded as finished. The already legitimate parliament elected in spring of 1990 is expected to create a number of further simple acts of parliament as well as those of constitutional significance. The first among them is drawing up the new constitution of Democratic Hungary. The wise words of the Hungarian philosopher of law, Barna Horváth, who left for New York in 1949 when the constitution of the Hungarian party state was adopted, reflect well the noble function and limitations of law in the process of the democratic transformation going on before our eyes. Quote, "It is the most beautiful task of lawyers to seek new techniques of democracy. The limits of performance of law warn us that one cannot expect only law to realize democracy. Law can always give only frame, patterns, ways, and methods. Law can only carve the bed of the river." Thank you for your attention.
Our next speaker, Dr. Daniel Krupa, is not only engaged in thinking about these problems, but in acting upon them. He is a member of the Czech and Slovak Federative Republic and their Constitutional Commission, where he is now involved in drafting a democratic constitution. He will speak to us with the assistance of an interpreter.
Dámy a pánové, před sametovou revolucí, která mě postavila do nynějšího postavení, jsem působil 20 let jako topič v kotelnách a studoval jsem filozofické klasiky Platona, Aristotela, Augustína a Tomáše Akvinského.
Ladies and gentlemen, before the Velvet Revolution, which brought me to my present position, I had been working as a stoker for about 20 years, while at the same time I was studying the classical philosophers like Plato and Aristotle.
Výsledky jsou dosti chudé. Dospěl jsem k určitému chápání svobody, po které jsme toužili, a rád bych vám několik postřehů z této doby sdělil.
The results are not to my complete satisfaction. I have come upon some notions of freedom during this my years of study, and I would like to tell or inform you about these notions.
Domnívám se, že je dvojí pojem svobody. Obojí však znamená veliký dar.
I think that basically there are two possible notions of freedom. Both mean ultimately that freedom is a great gift.
První je darem božím člověku. Je to svoboda rozhodování mezi dobrem a zlem.
The first is the gift from God. It's a freedom given to man to distinguish between good and bad.
Druhý pojem svobody je také dar, ale je to dar, který si lidé mohou poskytovat navzájem.
The second notion of freedom consists also in viewing freedom as a gift, but it is a gift which every man can offer or give to other.
Je to ten typ svobody, který mi právě poskytujete vy tím, že mlčíte a nasloucháte tomu, co já říkám.
It is a gift which you are now giving to me by being silent and listening to what I'm talking.
Uskutečnění té první svobody je možné jedině s podmínkou té svobody druhé. Jiným způsobem se ta první svoboda do světa dostat nemůže.
To make possible or to realize the first freedom or the freedom in the first concept is possible only through realizing the second freedom. There is no other way by which that freedom given from God can enter the world.
Svoboda v druhém smyslu je založena na dvojím možném postoji. Ten první politický postoj spočívá na respektu, na vzájemném uznání občanů.
The second concept may be realized, second kind of freedom may be realized by two doors. The first is in a political sense, whereby it is founded on mutual respects of human beings.
Druhý postoj je postoj lásky, vztahu mezi lidmi veskrze pozitivní, který teprve umožňuje člověku uskutečnit svoji podstatu.
In the second sense, the freedom is realized through love. That means a mutual cooperation or a mutual help, which people give to each other.
Vrátil bych se k tomu pojmu svobody, který je založen na respektu a který vstoupil do evropské civilizace v antickém Řecku, kde poprvé občané učinili ten krok a uznali navzájem rovnost svých práv před zákonem.
I will come back to the first political sense of freedom, which began in old classical Greek, when people gave each other recognition as equals before the law.
Řekové nazývali tuto svobodu isonomia a tento pojem je původnější než pojem demokracie.
Greeks called or named this equality isonomia, and this is much older concept than democracy.
Na základě tohoto konceptu se zrodila myšlenka vlády zákona.
It was upon this Greek concept that the notion of the rule of law was born.
V čem tato myšlenka spočívá, se pokusím ukázat na jejím opaku, s kterým se setkáváme právě v situaci přechodu od totalitního režimu k režimu demokratickému.
I would like to show you the basis upon which this notion is rooted. On an example which is now very clear when we are coming out of the totalitarian rule toward democratic one.
Mnoho lidí v Československu se domnívá, že zla totalitního režimu byla způsobena zlými komunisty a že náprava spočívá v tom, že na jejich místo nastoupí hodní křesťané.
Many people in Czechoslovakia think that the evilry of totalitarian rule was caused by the bad or evil men called communists, and that by replacing these evil men by good Christians, we shall solve our problems.
Myšlenka vlády zákona je však myšlenka opačná. Je to snaha, aby svoboda ve společnosti nezávisela na tom, zda lidé, kteří vstupují do vlády, jsou jednoznačně dobří nebo zlí.
But the justification for the notion of the rule of law is just the opposite. It is the idea is based upon the knowledge that you should base society upon the laws, so that the quality of the government within the society doesn't depend on whether or not the rules are good or bad.
Je to popření myšlenky, že moc je nadřízena zákonu. Popření myšlenky, že moc může používat zákona k svým cílům a účelům k ovládnutí společnosti.
Total denial of the idea that the power is superior to laws and that power is instrumental to governing society and more important than the laws themselves.
Při budování právního státu neboli vlády zákona v Československu je to právě tento problém, na který narážíme. problém užití zákona jako prostředku k dosažení nějakého cíle, ať už dobrého nebo zlého.
We are meeting this problem almost every day. The problem that many people think that the law is just an instrument to achieve some aims, good or bad.
Uvedu příklad. Jedním z důležitých kroků, který náš parlament přijal, byl restituční zákon, kterým se vrací majetek ukradený komunistickým režimem.
I'll give you one example. One of the laws our parliament passed was so-called the restitution of the communist property back to the people.
Majetky, které se vracejí, jsou majetky, které v mezidobí začaly sloužit různým vznešeným účelům, zdravotnictví, školství a také jako diplomatické budovy.
The properties which are now going to be returned back to the original owners has become where in the meantime serving quite noble aims. Some buildings served as hospitals, others as orphanages, and some even as houses of foreign diplomats.
Jestliže tyto domy vracíme původním majitelům, ničíme úkoly, kterým dosud sloužili. Na univerzitě nebudou prostory, kde by bylo možné přednášet studentům, budou chybět zdravotní střediska a Československo jako stát bude vystaven mezinárodní kritice, protože sebere budovy diplomatických zastupitelstv.
When we shall return these buildings back to the original owners, there will be many hospitals which will be endangered, some schools will lose their buildings, and even some diplomats will have to find new lodgings.
Je to ukázka toho, jak prosazení vlády zákona nás uvádí do těžko řešitelných situací. Přesto se domnívám, že pokračovat na této cestě přes všechny obtíže, které nás potkávají, je jedinou cestou, kterou naše země může jít k obnově svobody.
This example shows that establishment of the rule of law is bound to be connected with very painful situations. But I think that we have to persevere along this road, because only establishing the rule of law may safeguard our freedom in the long run.
Dosažení svobody se nám podaří jedině v případě, že se nenecháme svést z cesty, abychom vládu zákona uvedli do naší země a zabránili tak případné možnosti návratu z vůle mocných nad bezmocnými.
Only by attaining the rule of law we can prevent the return of the bad old days. There is no other way.
V podobné situaci je naše soudnictví. Obnova soudcovské nezávislosti závisí nejenom na obnovení jejich institucionální nezávislosti.
The same situation applies to our judiciary. The renewal of the respectability doesn't depend only on renewal of the independence.
Komunistický režim prosazoval svoji moc v soudnictví prostřednictvím vedoucí úlohy komunistické strany.
The communist regime enforced its governing over the judiciary by means of the leading role of the communist party.
Zrušením vedoucí úlohy komunistické strany však ještě nebyla obnovena nezávislost soudu v plném slova smyslu.
By abolishing this supremacy of the communist party, we did not renew the independence of judiciary.
To totiž předpokládá, že nejenom je nastolena institucionální nezávislost, ale také, že se objeví dostatek nezávislých osobností schopných tuto soudcovskou pravomoc vykonávat.
Because independent judiciary needs not only institutional independence, but also coming of strong independent persons who can really think independent as judges.
Obnovení soudcovské nezávislosti a vlády zákona i v soudnictví předpokládá další dva kroky, A to je vybudování správního soudnictví, které teprve umožní lidem odvolat se v případě, že státní správa se dopustí porušení zákona.
We need to build administrative courts which will be capable of redressing some injustices caused by administrative bodies.
A teprve na základě vybudování správního soudnictví bude možné obnova soudu ústavního.
And only when we build up the administrative courts will we be able to build a constitutional court.
A pak teprve budeme moci hovořit o nastolení právě vlády zákona, totiž v případě, budou-li se moci občané dovolat svých ústavních práv.
It will be only then that we will be able to talk about the rule of law, the meaning that only when a smallest individual will be able to find a hearing for his own injustices or all his wrongs.
Okay.
I don't know if you noticed the byplay, but there was a keen sense of anticipation, both philosophical and practical. Just as I handed the note that said time was up, the speaker drew his remarks to a conclusion, extrasensory perception. Our final speaker on the panel, Honorable Michael Novak, holds the George Frederick Jewett Chair in Religion and Public Policy at the American Enterprise Institute. I think many of us, perhaps most of us in the audience, have read at least some of his books, particularly The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism. Mr. Novak.
Thank you very much. I'm very grateful once again to the Federalist Society for making this all possible. For me in particular, the grandson of immigrants from Czechoslovakia, it's been marvelous to hear so much of the language of my grandparents spoken today. I hear and remember so many sounds and accents, although I must confess to you that my parents deliberately didn't teach us Slovak at home, precisely so that we wouldn't understand everything that they were saying. And I now am paying the price for that. It was just 7 months ago that I sat in an office at the foot of Wenceslas Square in Prague with Daniel and Pavel. Both of them were just then running for their seats in the legislature. It was in May. We were sitting in the building that had belonged to the Communist Party until just a few weeks prior to that, now the headquarters of Civic Forum. We had to sit in a small room because there was a delegation from Bulgaria in the large meeting room where it hoped to be. We were sitting in the sun, with the sun beating in on us, a little round room in the turret. And while I was curious to talk about the immediate political situation, they wanted to talk about philosophy and theology as it bore on politics. And I'm very happy to find that continued today, Daniel, in your remarks. A friend of mine from the Soviet Union also told me a story that will set the tone for my own remarks. That the problem with socialism was, he said, best compared with the situation of Adam and Eve in the garden. They had, he said, only an apple to eat, and all around them kept coming announcements that they were living in paradise. Now, the road from there to where we all want to go, and where all the peoples of Eastern Europe want to go, is difficult for another reason besides those already spoken. Let me take a paraphrase, a sentence from Tolstoy. He said something about the all happy families being happy in the same way and every unhappy family being unhappy in a unique way. Well, there's something like that about socialism and societies that are democratic, capitalist, and pluralist. All socialist societies are remarkably the same. And all democratic, capitalist, and pluralist societies are each unique. And so it should not surprise us if we see in the conversations these days that each one of our nations will follow a different road in the way it adapts its institutions. It's in the very nature of freedom itself and freedom's interplay with reality. I mean, what we want most of all is to be realistic and in touch with human life as it is. I thought Dean Kramer helped us focus on this point in his own unique and original way this morning. We first met, as I recall, 29 years ago when we were teaching together in the general education program at Harvard, as he reminded me. But I thought when he said that we should remember that the separation of powers is more an intermingling, and let me add, a balance of powers, and that the secret to it is flexibility in the joints, that he was making a very conservative, not a progressive point, as I understand it. Conservative in this sense, that in two senses. First, when the Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as he pointed out, threatened us with excessive presidential power, it seemed to me a legitimate conservative reaction to try to check excessive presidential power. And when, having lost presidential power, the more statist of our parties, the second most capitalist party in the world, but still the most statist of our parties, reaches for excessive congressional power or excessive judiciary power, it's quite consistent, I think, to want to check that. In other words, I think the consistency lies in checking excessive power, whether it goes to one branch of our threefold system or the others. And in the same way, I'd like to bring to light, if I may, two presuppositions of the phrase the rule of law, and then I would like to apply this particularly to the judiciary. The rule of law has as one of its presuppositions, in a plain and ordinary sense of rule of law, that if there are fair and minimal rules, energetic citizens will take the initiative to do what they have to do. But please note that's a presupposition which may not hold in all societies. It may not be the case in all societies that there are energetic citizens ready to take initiative. It is something we take for granted. I think we take it for granted, will you allow a theologian to say, because we share an inheritance from Judaism and from Christianity, which are, among the world religions, the religions of history. The religions which taught us that we were made by the Creator in the Creator's image. That is, we have a responsibility in our lifetimes to create, not to take the world as it was given to us, but bring it closer to the kingdom of God yet to come in the future. We have an obligation to change history. And that has inspired Jewish and Christian civilization from the beginning, in the variety, civilizations I should say, in the variety, to be extraordinarily dynamic. Now, one reason for hope in Eastern Europe, I think, is that this dynamism is there, this tradition is shared, to be called on, to be blown back to life as one blows on embers, to bring the flame back. There, and this might, I might say, contrasts very sharply with the Marxist statist image of a citizenry which is passive and subject, who cannot be expected to take initiative or to act on their own, for whom all the instruments need to be supplied. Land, privatization of land, they will be inclined to say, won't work. Because people, if you give them the land, won't have the fertilizer and won't have the tools. It doesn't seem to occur to them that if people have the land, they will want the fertilizer and the tools. And because they want it, somebody will get into his head to start supplying them and make a profit in that. And supplying the tools, they will be able to make the money that's necessary to pay. And the energy of society will grow of itself. In other words, on the one hand, there's assumption that people have the energy if the rules are fair. And on the other hand, the notion that people are basically subject and don't have the energy, and you really must supply everything, and then there will come liberty. I think Dostoevsky expressed this exceedingly well when he opposed the difference between bread first, then liberty, or I think the idea more fair to human nature, at least as Jews and Christians understand human nature, liberty first. If you give people liberty, they'll find the bread. Honestly, they will. It's two different hypotheses about what will work. And they have been put to the test. I think the Japanese and other East Asians are terribly important because without being Jewish or Christian, they showed that it works. If you give liberty, they've suddenly produced the bread in such abundance as they never saw before, and in such abundance as threatens to put us in the shadow. Right, it's a wonderful proof that we are talking about the system of natural liberty, not the system of Jewish Christian liberty. It's a very powerful point we've lived through in our time that needs to be absorbed. The second lesson behind the rule of law and the reason for the balance of systems used to be described as the notion of original sin. It's not an accident that Madison was most influenced in his studies at Princeton by the most Calvinist member of the faculty, who taught him above all the wreckage that original sin has written into human history. We put this sign on our coins and our dollar bill. It says, "In God we trust," whose operational meaning is, "and in nobody else." You can't trust other human beings. Certainly can't trust them with too much power. For everybody else, there are checks and there are balances. It's hard to contrast this. It's important to contrast this with the Marxist idea, which is that of the new man, who will be virtuous, compassionate, love the society, unselfish, once you do away with private property or something like that. Our framers have always had the idea that you might as well build a republic for sinners if you're going to build a republic, because that's all there are. It's the only moral majority there is. There's no use building a republic for saints because there aren't enough to fill a republic. And the ones there are impossible to live with. So let's just admit we're all sinners and we all need checks and balances, and start to contrive our institutions with that in mind. And that's how you bring about the rule of law, paradoxically, by facing the lawlessness that is in each of us. We aspire to. I want to point out that there's a wrong interpretation of Calvinism, which says that, you know, human beings are totally depraved, period. The real meaning of Calvinism was put to me by a professor at Calvin College, who said, "The fellow who said man is totally depraved couldn't be all bad." It means most of the time we're good, decent, generous, etc., but not always. So don't trust anybody. It's excessive to trust people all the time, and therefore you need checks. On the other hand, most of the time people will, in favorable structures, perform well. That's what makes democracy, capitalism, and pluralism possible. And the fact that we sometimes fail is what makes them necessary, as Reinhold Niebuhr said. Now, the second major point I wanted to come to is of a slightly different order, and it has more to do with the problem of the next panel, that of separatism and federalism, but it bears precisely on the judiciary and rights. To protect individual rights, minorities, even such things that matter, especially in Europe, of linguistic and cultural traditions, and their integrity and their autonomy, and the independent judiciary is one instrument for doing that. Now, here again, I want to call on the principle that was so dear to Madison, the enlargement of the orbit, and show how it's actually working in Eastern Europe today. Madison argued that all those writers about republican government were wrong who said that a republic would only work in a small territory. Aristotle thought the republic would only work if it were in a city large enough so that every citizen could hear an orator's voice, and you could have a public discussion. Now, Madison said the opposite is the case. You need a large territory, because in any small territory, one family, one party, one group, or one interest can so dominate that they will corrupt the courts or corrupt every instrument. In a larger sphere, there is a greater chance for the rule of law to obtain, because this local power will be checked by other powers at some other location. They say Jimmy Carter's great problem was that in the Democratic Party, there were two power centers that he had to meet. He had to keep one foot in Georgia, and he had to keep one foot in Massachusetts to worry about a rival party. And that explains the pain he felt right about Washington. In Europe, the smaller peoples are beginning more and more to have appeal to the Council of Europe, and the precedents established by the Council of Europe, the Convention of Human Rights of European law, and the concrete case law by which the Council of Europe is proceeding, are bringing a good combination of our rights tradition and our case law tradition to the service of smaller European countries that might or might not find a way to work their way towards this. They have an existing body of law and precedent which they can incorporate in their own legal battles. Mr. Rychetski has a very fine passage in this in his paper, which is out on the table, about how this will work in Czechoslovakia. And I think it's a very good road toward helping alleviate the problems of minorities and separatist tendencies. If we could persuade people in Eastern Europe that the economic dynamics are leading toward interdependence, and that this is good for human rights, that the enlarged orbit is actually better for the protection of small groups, we would have both an economic and a rights argument for countering separatist tendencies. I think in practice this will turn out to work very well, because it all, as I mentioned last night, for the case of the Bretons and the Basques, the Council of Europe is providing protection they heretofore didn't have in Madrid and in Paris. And I think this may happen for the Slovaks and the Moravians and for the Moldavians and the Georgians and for others throughout as there gets to be a set of laws covering all of Europe. I apologize for going so long.
Thank you. Dr. Novak's comments remind me that I should perhaps add to the international character of our group assembled here by telling you that my father was an immigrant from what later became Latvia, and my mother was an immigrant from Moscow. The truth, as always, does not lie in the extremes. We have been talking about the rule of law. I am reminded, however, of the philosopher's observation that governments do not go like clocks, they depend on men. Be the system ever so evil, officials great enough will make it go well. But be the system ever so good, evil officials can pervert it. So we do not, obviously there is much to be said for the rule of law. There is also much to be said for the people who make the government go and the quality and integrity of those people. We have time for just two questions. And rather than call for any discussion on the panel, I want to see if we've got one or two really good questions from the audience. Yes, please.
It was suggested that the rule of law originated with the Greeks. I'd like to suggest that there was an earlier origin, and it came with the Jews in our tradition. We see in the book of Deuteronomy that it was said by the Lord to the judges, judgment is mine, so don't listen to the rich, don't be partial to the rich or the poor, the judgment is mine. There was therefore a sacred trust in the judiciary to judge according to God's justice, responsible to God. In our tradition in this country, for as long as we've been in this country, and even before this nation became an independent nation, the judges coming in office take an oath of office and would take this oath on a Bible, thus reaffirming in part, the responsibility to God, also reaffirming the nature of a vow, that there is such a thing as a vow and responsibility, and responsibility to God, symbolized in the Bible, as well as to the Constitution and Republic and all who observe. This hasn't been mentioned. I believe it's not unimportant. Justice Brennan scoffed at this. This is just a formality. To the people of this land, it is not just that. And so the question is, an address to the those who would speak from knowledge of the different emerging new nations in the Eastern Europe, where atheism has been the official position, and now that's dropped. Will the new judiciary return to this tradition, whether it is done with all sincerity of heart or as a mere formality, as Justice Brennan might suggest? Is it something that should be done?
Professor Damasco, would you undertake, perhaps because of the difficulty?
No.
Please. There goes my excuse. I said that my microphone was not in order. It is one of those immensely complicated questions to which giving a simple answer may be misleading. As I said, the conception of the rule of law is so vague. I was trying to bring in some separate strands, and it goes much further. And it is true that you may say that, in my opinion, that some of the roots of the rule of law can be traced to Judaism, a monotheism in some sense, particularly in the Western European tradition. If you look at cultures like the Chinese culture, you see, it is true that they had something like a constitutional constraint on the rulers. So they were talking about the mandate from heaven. Some specialist in Chinese history may remember this. It is true that in some general sense it may be linked to our Western tradition of monotheism in some sorts and can be traced back to the Middle Ages. But I really cannot much speculate about the link between the religious upsurge or revival in most Eastern European countries and the rule of law. But there is no question in my mind that you have in the void left by communism, you have this tendency, even among the young in most Eastern European countries, to fill the void at the individual level with religion. Because communism and the communist ideology, I know that full well because I was growing up in that society, had answers at the level of society. You were moving in the direction of some kind of a perfect society. It was a progression towards heaven on earth. However, individually, we all growing up felt the spiritual void because religion was prohibited, because we have in our own individual life, the decline, and you start thinking about the meaning of life, etc. There was a tremendous void left, and that is being filled now in all Eastern European countries in various ways. But you see, we all try to find purposes that transcend ourselves narrowly. So you should not be surprised that in the individual level you have an upsurge of religion, and at the social level, in many countries, even that they don't have, they're not cursed with the nationalities problems that you have, let's say, in the Soviet Union or in Yugoslavia, you find a revival in nationalism, some ethos, some Herderian thing harking back to the 19th century. How this relates to a rule of law is such a complicated issue in which I really I don't even dare to speculate. But I think that you're right that there is some linkage between religion and the origin and the rule of law.
In Western Europe, they still have state churches. In the United States, we do not, but they share this acknowledgement of stewardship before divinity. And the reference to under God was only put in our Pledge of Allegiance in the 1950s. This is current. And so the question, which you haven't answered, is it something for these Eastern nations to look at as a current and alive practice?
Thank you. I think I'm going to have to be the evil man who makes the clock go, or at least the evil man whose actions are governed by the clock, and ask the audience to try to consider that for themselves. I remind you that we will have only a 5-minute rest break. We'll try to resume promptly at the end of 5 minutes so that we can give the last panel time for its discussions. I want to thank the panelists very much.
Yes.